Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. You know, we took a little bit of time off here recently, and we put up what we thought were our, I think it was four or five of our best episodes of the, 150 plus that we've done.
I think 174 is where we are right
174,
now.
174, all right. The best 100 of the 174, you know. So we did that, gave you a little bit of opportunity to hear those best ofs. But we're back for better or worse. And, of course, it's myself, Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. Hey. And, you know, we thought today, you know, the big news of the day was the parade that I guess it's over now. It happened technically today, but it was, I think it was yesterday for us. It was the third for the Chinese. And of course it was China's parade and celebration for the 80th anniversary of victory in World War II. And it was an opportunity for Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, and then there were some other leaders that were there as well to, you know, to celebrate China's victory over the Japanese. And so, and then they, interestingly, they demonstrated some new systems, which Curtis will talk about and Jim will talk about, some new nuclear systems.
Adam, I have a question. It's the three of them together. Did they go out to a restaurant? Where did they go? Chinese restaurant, Korean restaurant, or I don't know, Slavic?
Russian
food. I mean, Russian food is mostly large glasses of vodka.
Without the dinner. Okay.
They probably did.
Yeah, I didn't hear any of that in the news anyway.
I'm sure there was a state dinner that would have, you know, sort of fit the bill. But what I found interesting about it, I guess I'll sort of take the top rope on this one. What I found interesting on it was, you know, this, the Great Patriotic War, World War II, is about the most influential event in, you know, Russian history, or at least in living memory. How about that? Mm-hmm. In living memory. And so for Vladimir Putin to not be home for, you know, I guess maybe because the Germans surrendered in May as opposed to August.
Yeah, they already
maybe
celebrated.
Yeah, so that would make sense then. But yeah, so I take it back. I was thinking in terms, but you know, the Russians also declared war on the Japanese, although they, you know, there really wasn't any fighting.
They were a little
late,
weren't they?
They were kind of late to it. You know, they were, you know, what was it, August 8th, I think, that they declared war.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an opportunity though for those authoritarians. 'Cause you know, you also had the president of Belarus and you had some other authoritarian leaders that were at this event. It was a little shindig for authoritarians, and it was, you know, they're very clear. And if you heard Xi's comments, you can watch the entire 2.5 hour parade online. But it was, you know, Xi gave some comments where he clearly was, you know, poking the United States. But, you know, Jim, let me turn to you first. You know, what was your take on it and sort of what they demonstrated? Of course, Xi took the opportunity to talk about how our parade was kind of a demonstration of sort of how weak, you know, when President Trump did the army parade for its 250th, how weak we are.
Hoo-ah.
But that's right. You know, for those who don't know, Jim's retired army, you know, so what was your take on this parade, Jim, and what it meant and what the message they were trying to send?
The first thing I saw on that parade, and it was rather interesting. I looked at it almost as a sales pitch. Like, China has a lot of toys. I'm not sure they know how to use them all in combat, but they certainly have a lot. And they have a lot of interesting things that they've done. And I've, you know, I went, as we were preparing for this podcast, I went back and listened to a few comments made, especially by the great Curtis McGiffin, who's going to speak next, I'm sure. Now he's listening. Wake up, Eric Curtis. Yeah, so, but the great Curtis McGiffin, who I always attribute to my view of whack-a-mole theory, where you got to have a lot of different things to take out or to get your adversary to think, I'm just not going to get through with this. And I think that was my most impressive view of the parade. A lot of things out there to demonstrate, a lot of toys on the market, a lot of things that might be interesting to those other two pals that were there with Xi Jinping, along with 26 total countries, you know, represented at that parade that were not really part of the victory celebration at the time. But certainly decided to join in for the celebration with China and were able to see what was happening there. So my biggest takeaway there was a variety of options, not only for sale, but for use. So I'll put it both ways, that China is considering as a deterrent and possibly as for aggression against the U.S. in order to make us think, you know, what's out there and how many things are there. Certainly an incredible amount of technology, and a lot of it, and I think we talked about this in the show prep, a lot of it looked very, very familiar to what I've seen, I don't know, other places in the world. Curtis is going to talk about that, I'm sure, in which they had the capability of adding to the mix in fighting of nuclear and conventional cyber, certainly AI is a big hit. I even think there was a comment by Xi Jinping. So I listened to some of the edited comments that were made that they believe that AI is a game changer for them because of their command structure. So the speed at which to make decisions when you're top down driven instead of the United States military view being the bottom up. When you're top down driven, you need to even make your decisions faster. Otherwise, you stymie your military, and that gives them an advantage through the AI if it could be making the decisions for them. I don't know. Maybe they don't even need any leaders. They'll just let the AI do it. Although I'm not sure that's going to work out very well. The other thing, as I said, the people, the number of countries that showed up at this this parade are rather interesting. And I'm very, very interested in what's going to be said afterwards, what deals were possibly made on the ground while they were there. I know North Korea, you know, seems to be somewhat stymied in old time, you know, structure in terms of its military and updating its technology and updated capability. But conventional nuclear and a lot of it was shown there. So that's my out-of-the-box thinking.
Curtis, what was your
thing? Well, I'll give a couple of observations here. First of all, the Chinese know how to put on a parade, right? If you watch the videos on YouTube and wherever
else. Isn't it mostly just all communists know how to put on parades?
I think so. It could be. But I mean, the marching is so crisp, it almost looks like it's AI, right? Like they're all automatrons because it's just so perfect. You watch the American parade, you know, we're all out of step and, you know, our uniforms are all, you know, soft and nothing starched anymore. It's just a different perspective. I will say a lot of dignitaries mentioned 26 different countries were there, probably some of the wealthiest socialist autocratic people in the world were there.
For sale.
What is little known is the president of Iran was there. So really all four of the Axis of Evil were present. And this, I think, was the first time that Iran has been at a function since President Trump obliterated their nuclear systems and research. I am particularly fond of President Trump's statement where he said, President Xi, please give my fondest regard, my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America. Probably one of the most poignant, humorous statements that a president could make. Given the moment, because all of this was tied to a Shanghai Cooperative Organization meeting, which is sort of the antithesis of everything Western dominated. in with regard to relationships, trade agreements, borderline agreements for defense relationships, and at least cooperation. But I think what we saw here was for the first time with the big three, right? Putin, Xi, and KJU on the same stage, you saw the real personification of this cooperation that has been talked about in within sort of the expert arenas here since the 2023 release of the Strategic Posture Commission report, which was sort of the first one to come out and say, we have to think about all of these as one, right? And so as we're looking at this issue, these are, I think, some of the some of the big challenges. So mentioned there were three new nuclear systems paraded in this event yesterday. And I think, you know, we are the deterrence podcast. Nuclear weapons is sort of our wheelhouse, so that's where I think we should pay some attention to. And so, what were those three systems? Actually, technically, there were four. I'm gonna take a step back. There were four nuclear systems that I want to mention. So the DF-5C, which is not a new system, but the C model is a newly upgraded version. Was paraded in three sections, although it's a two-stage system, liquid-fueled missile, intercontinental ballistic missile that carries multiple megaton systems. One estimate in the UK, one of the UK newspapers, was that it could carry up to 10 warheads at 4 megatons each, is what the speculation is. That's a lot of throw weight.
It's a shame we don't have anything that carries multiple warheads.
Yeah, but it's certainly not multi-megaton warheads. Even if there were one megaton warheads, that'd be a lot. So they paraded that out. They showed off what a new system called the DF-31 BJ Bravo Juliet. This is a upgraded solid fuel system of the DF-31 that is already been reported, or at least posited in the last China report to Congress that might be sitting in some of the silos, and that the fact that this is now a solid fuel is supposed to make it more reliable and mobile, i.e. can they get it in and out of the silos quicker and these sorts of things. So this is a challenge. The DF-31 is known to be MIRVable, perhaps up to, up to three or more systems. It just depends on what level of warhead they want to put on there. And then the new one was this DF-61. Now, of course, we don't know what's inside the tubes marked DF-61, but there was a new system painted out there called the DF-61, riding on the same, the TEL number, how many wheels on that TEL there? I think it's 11 axle TEL, a system carrying the missile, same size as the DF-41. My guess is, I'm just purely speculating, that the 61 is probably some upgraded version of the 41. The 41 was not paraded this time, which I thought was interesting. And then finally, there was a new the new JL-1, which is their air-launched ballistic missile, sort of creating their triad now that would be hung under the belly of the H-6N bomber, the 1950s era bomber that they built new ones in the 90s. And, I always like to remind Adam, who is a big fan of the Pershing 2 missile, this JL-1 looks just like it. Go figure. and then they paraded the JL-3 submarine launch ballistic missile as well. I don't think that's a first timer, but they directed energy weapons and a whole bunch of hypersonic systems, some of them new, the YJ series, that are of concern in the region, the DF-26 Guam Buster and so forth. So there was a lot, but the parade was shorter, significantly smaller from what they've had in the past. And I think, there were only four systems abreast rather than larger systems, and only usually one or two deep rather than multiple in length of the parade. So I think there was some give and take there. So those are my initial thoughts.
Hey, Curtis, while our audience may be thinking about your comment about rockets, I just wanted to mention the solid fuel rocket, of course, can be launched very quickly because it's and extremely mobile. I believe the liquid fuel gives it, of course, you know, like our first moon landing was made with liquid fuel rockets, higher technology, a little few more options. Yeah. But it just tells you where their mindset is. If they get solid fuel rockets, you know, they're ready to go. And that's right. Important. Sorry, Adam. I just wanted to make sure I made that connection for our audience.
Well, this DF-61 is liquid fueled. So for a new system, they're still building new liquid fueled systems too. Yep. What's the advantage, Jim? Why would you still build new systems with liquid fuel?
You get more thrust.
Is that what it is? That's what, okay. That makes sense.
And you can vary if with the fuel. Some rockets, you can change their, you know, change the dynamics, change the way they operate by changing, you know, how much fuel is in them or not in them. So it gives you a little more flexibility. But as Adam said, it's really the bigger thrust and the faster rocket. Okay. But it takes time to fill it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, when we shifted from, you know, liquid fuel, you know, Titans, for example, and we went to Minuteman, those were smaller, you know, smaller missiles. And then that drove our need to have much smaller warheads. You know, so even when we had, you know, when we, let's say we had three RVs on a, you know, on a Minuteman, those suckers are, I mean, optimized for weight and size because that solid booster just, you know, just doesn't have the thrust. I mean, but it's safer. They last a long time. That, you know, after Damascus, you know, in 1982, you really, you know, that was sort of a wake-up call on just that the, you know, it could be sort of things you don't really think about, you know, dropping a wrench that causes a, you know, an explosion of a liquid-fueled rocket. So, you know, that's your trade-offs, but we have the weapons designers who have the ability to, you know, do exactly what we needed done. That's the amazing thing, is that the weapons designers have been able to build all kinds of stuff to use, you know, optimize the weight of special nuclear material, all kinds of stuff. It's just amazing what they've been able to do over the years to meet those demands. So, but what does it tell you about what the Chinese want? The Chinese want, they want to have more warheads, more reentry vehicles on their rockets. Mm-hmm. And they want to, you know, assume, and if they're bigger, let's suppose, you know, because if it's a megaton class warhead, that's going to be a lot heavier and it's going to be a bigger reentry vehicle because you need a bigger warhead. And what that generally tells me is that they don't have the guidance systems and the guidance system accuracy that we have. And that is, you know, a significant, you know, because normally the more accurate your RV is, you know, the lower the yield you need, and therefore yields go down.
It doesn't. Ahead, it also tell you a little bit more about their operation too. It's easier to hit a city, big target, versus a military installation or, you know, individual holes in the ground. So it tells you a little bit more about what their plan is with at least their nuclear weapons.
So I see it just slightly, maybe a little bit split in the middle between the two of you in that. They're not interested in a counter force strategy. Yep. They're really interested in a counter value strategy, and they're interested in holding at risk the American population. These are terror weapons in that sense. And that their goal is to scare Americans into ensuring their government doesn't get engaged in or get in the way of Chinese rejuvenation or unification or whatever term that they want to use to describe their world as they're creating it. And I think the problem here is that the Chinese are not doing a very good job of explaining to the American people just what threat they're under, right? If your goal is to convince the American people to convince President Trump or Biden or anybody who comes afterwards not to get involved in this because we don't want to get nuked, they've got to do a better job at messaging to the American people. They do it very subversively. And I'm saying this in somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but the reality here is that when you load up DF-5 systems that are built to carry a lot of thrust, throw weight in order to carry multiple megaton warheads long distances. They're not interested in accuracy. They're only interested in destroying large population centers, or at least holding them at risk, the threat of them, in order to convince us not to get involved or engaged. And so that is the ultimate goal. And if you look at, if you listen to Xi's speech, it goes along those lines with regard to their ideas of sovereignty and shared or balance of power in the sense of political power, that they feel that they've been subjugated, they have grievances against the West, and they feel that, that this is the only way they're going to reestablish some sort of balance in their minds, is to do it through force. And as long as we allow that to happen, it'll probably get achieved.
So yes, Well, I was going to say from a historical standpoint, though, I mean, that's what this parade was about, right? Is showing your power, et cetera. But yeah. And I was going to turn it back to Adam anyway, because Adam, when you talk about the history lesson that the Chinese learned, especially from the Japanese, is there was a lot of terror in the way that Japan, fought in Myanmar, et cetera, because, that happened long before what we think of as World War II starting. I mean, the fight had begun long before that.
The 30s.
And it was terribly, terribly horrible on the public of China. And I think they learned that lesson, that it was, I don't know how it would have turned out for them had World War II not started and we had more, Japan had spread out its forces. Maybe you could talk about that. I was looking that up. I didn't find any information.
Historic
context.
Well, think about the rape of Nanking. That was how many millions? I think I've read up to 3 to 5 to 10 million died in that. I mean, there were so many millions that died. We don't exactly know how many died. And then just the way that the Japanese were, and this is something that General Chun, General Im Bum Chun, our friend and colleague and Korean general has said, is that, you Americans, you don't want to kill people. And you have to understand that, the Asian way of war is brutal. It's abjectly brutal. Yeah. And so for the Chinese, go back to the Korean War, and I'll paraphrase Mao whenever Douglas MacArthur said, we should nuke China. And General MacArthur said, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing, he said, well, if you kill 250 million, there's still 250 million more. He was willing to trade bodies for, ultimate victory. And, if you looked at the quote unquote volunteer, armies led by, I think it was Peng Dehuai that led the volunteers into, Korea, they lost we were killing 10 to 1 at least, but that's just, that was not what they valued, because, in a communist ideology, and it's somewhat consistent with, Chinese sort of history and culture, is that the individual only matters in terms of how they contribute to the safety and stability of the state. Whereas in a Western culture, particularly in America, more than any place else, it is I, the individual, who matters for my own sake. My existence isn't only valuable in how I support and contribute and defend the state. I matter. The state doesn't. The state's job is to maximize my freedom and my liberty. That's a totally different way of looking at it.
That's a great way to lay it out.
So, and the other thing, just to sort of poke at you, Curtis, I wonder, though, will the Chinese, is it that they don't want to be accurate? Because if they're going to build a peer or superior force to the United States, but let's say within a decade, I would think that they would want to have escalation paths that don't require them to, take out New York or LA or whatever. I would think they would want to be able to hit discrete military targets so that they can say, okay, we hit a discrete military target in North Dakota. Let's stop here as opposed, because they know if you take out Dallas or LA, that we're going to have to escalate and fight back. I mean, the American people would not tolerate it otherwise. So I would think they have to want to do that. And my question is do they have the technology for it? And
I
don't know.
It's done regionally, right? They'll hold American forces in the Pacific at risk. We have a territory of Guam, state of Hawaii, Aleutian Islands. There is plenty of territory for them to strike without having to even use an ICBM. So the idea that they have an escalation ladder of many rungs is absolutely the case. And, you know, here we have an era right now where President Trump, for example, is busting his political behind trying to negotiate a peace between Ukraine and Russia. Right. His statement is, I really don't care how it ends. I just want to stop the fighting. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And here in this speech yesterday, President Xi notes that he emphasized that humanity now faces a choice between peace or war. Humanity, a choice between peace or war. That's the Chinese perspective. So this understanding that there is, or this idea that there is just some sort of we can all get along mentality that they speak of doesn't hear very well if you live in the Philippines. It doesn't hear very well if you are in Taiwan or Japan or Korea. I would argue it doesn't hear very well in Vietnam, though they probably attended this shindig. But I think here that there is a number of challenges that they have to be. He notes that the Chinese people are not afraid of violence.
Yeah.
As if the Americans are. Well, the Americans are inherently, I think, a peaceful people, even though our history isn't necessarily replete with long timelines of peace. But often, sometimes these conflicts are thrust upon us. Other times we thrust ourselves unnecessarily into conflict. But the reality is that we've got a Xi Jinping that is interested in showing at least his corner of the world, the 26 countries that attended and many others, that he is not only firmly in control, that he's got a military force and an economy, for that matter, to back it up. And so his goal is not about anything other than getting out there and speaking that. There's one of the quotes in one of the articles was that Wednesday's massive display of force offered Xi a stage to show his guests that China not only has the ambition, but also the military power to back up his vision. What he was really displaying was his ability to coerce and to subjugate.
Mm-hmm.
And to really large degrees, and so I hope that the American indeed the Western audience is listening to this as for what it is.
Yeah, Curtis, I think and I'd be interested in both yours and Adam's take on this that you made me think about was that we tried to build coalitions to maintain either status quo or peace or, you know, deter aggression. But the impression I got just from the statements that were made in the by Xi Jinping, by the very deliberate words that he had used, were almost that he was forming a group of people for aggression, not for maintaining peace or treaties. And that's why I said it was one of two things. Mm-hmm. It was either to be aggressive. The flip side of that is to build a relationship again, an economic relationship, because certainly Russia would benefit from a military trade relationship with China. I don't think China would gain much. Russia's, you know, their economy's faltering as quickly as possible. Probably not going to get much better. And same thing for North Korea. So I'm not sure how that relationship works, unless it's a similar relationship as China has made with Indonesia and with Vietnam, in which they go in and trade one thing for another, but then the payback is much bigger than what's mm-hmm. given out. And that might be another piece of this. I'm curious what your thoughts are, looking at it historically, but also look at it from a political science standpoint. That's not my thing.
I don't know that I can answer that. Instead, I'm going to answer the question I want to answer.
Well, Thanks a lot, Curtis. And that is, really gets a lot out of that.
When you're a country, there's really three ways you're going to get your friends, right? You can earn them, you can buy them, or you can coerce them. Yeah. And he's choosing to do the latter of the two because it's very difficult to earn them.
Okay, that's good.
But I'm going to disagree with you, Curtis, because I don't think they're coercing them. I think they think that, you know, this is a return to the Middle Kingdom, and the Chinese believe that they have a right to preeminence.
Okay,
they are the long established civilization. They're the most powerful civilization, and they believe that because of that, they shouldn't have to coerce or use force, that you should look to them. And I mean, this is, they fully expect, you know, this will be a return to a tributary system where, you know, the Vietnamese and, you know, these other countries, you know, Chosun, Korea, you know, and Japan, and will send, you know, delegations every year to pay their tribute to the emperor, i.e. Xi, and that's sort of the way, and maybe instead of it just being sort of an East Asian thing, that because of technology, it should be global, and that, you know, the nations of Europe and others should recognize the preeminence of China. And remember, China has said that, you know, they have preeminence over the moon too. So it's this planet and others.
Right. So a tributary system is just another version of subjugation. So we're still right back where I am. And if you don't play this tributary system, then you will be coerced. I mean, look at how they're treating the Philippines, for example. There was a moment when they had a president that was willing to work with China, and their system sort of changed. And then they had another election, and now they're bumping boats again. So there is an effort to coerce until you sort of give in. And so all of that seems to work. I want to pull a quote here from an article that came out in Joseph Trevithick in there. I think he's the War Zone. And he quoted a guy named Jonathan Sin, who is an analyst at Brookings, former CIA China experts, what's purported in the article here. He says that the four leaders, their joint attendance at the parade was disconcerting and allows them to present a facade of partnership. He wrote a quote, however, it's highly likely that this is a symbolic high water mark for their partnership rather than a portent of deeper quadrilateral cooperation among them, and that North Korea and Iran, dangerous as they are much more minor players, blah, blah, blah. This is really the sort of complacent thinking that has put us in this situation now, right? So this is the same old thinkers who see this axis of evil, these mavens of malice, as I call them, as being sort of, you know, Larry Moe Curley and Shimp all sort of running around bopping each other in the head, but trying to get to the end of the show together. The reality is that, you know, these aren't dummies. These aren't unmotivated people. They possess vast amounts of wealth and resources and landmass and populations. And this is a big problem. And I would argue that if you look at the SCO, many members of the SCO, as well as observant members, are nuclear powers. It is only the U.S., France, and the U.K. that is not engaged in the SCO in some way, as far as official nuclear powers. And so this is a real issue, and we have to understand that. And even as minor as Iran and North Korea may be presented to be by analysts like this, they are the enablers. They are second generation proliferators who are putting global stability at risk. You know, Russia as well. I gotcha, but they're doing it too. And to sort of dismiss them as minor annoyances, I think is folly. And we've got to get past this complacent thinking, and we need to prepare for the next world that's coming. And it is going to be based on hard power, and we better be ready for it.
Yet the thing that I was poking at that you sort of brought up, which I appreciate, is that I'm not sure all three, the three main players, Russia, North Korea, and of course China, they are a friendship by necessity,
sure,
not necessarily all in agreement, which puts me to, and Adam, again, I just like the historical view, is I look at the China's view as sort of like the American manifest destiny concept, that it's our right, it's our moving forward. Do you see it the same way? And then how does that conflict with North Korea and Russia, as Curtis just agreed with?
Yeah, I mean, in many respects, it's a analogy. All analogies are false, some are useful. And it's, yep, it's like that. I mean, it's, we believed we had a fundamental God-given right to go from sea to shining sea, and we did. And the Chinese for, 2000 years-ish, was the Middle Kingdom. They were, they saw themselves as the preeminent, the empire under the sun, that they were, the Japanese were the empire of the sun, but they saw themselves as the preeminent empire, and that the emperor was, was God's appointed. And, the kingdom of Korea was Joseon, and they sent a delegation every year, and the Vietnamese and the Laotians, and, they had different names back in those days. But all these countries sent delegations. I'd be willing to bet that the Tibetans often sent it, even though they fought each other, and Tibet sometimes won and was the preeminent power. But, you had all of these groups sending delegations, and the Japanese did it, the Filipinos did it, and it was just, it was the perception of how things should be. And they're, because remember, the Chinese are by nature are backward looking people, right? They don't, they, mm-hmm, they believe they have a history. And they look to that history for lessons, mm-hmm, for today, right? That's why, Mao's 36 aphorisms, were all ancient Chinese aphorisms. Or, Xi Jinping looks to the Warring States period in, 500 BC for his lessons on strategy and wisdom. I mean, the Spring and Autumn Annals, that's sort of where he goes for, strategy. And that's just their nature, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just the way they operate, and it sort of is what it is. And it's something that we have to deal with. And then the question for we the Americans is are we confident that we can in our system? And this is my fear, is that we're, the U.S., if you look at it, it has because as we tax at a rate that we've never taxed before. So the government consumes more of the economy than it ever has. And governments are not known for their efficiency and innovation. They're just not. And so my question, and things are more expensive when the government buys them than they ever have been. How do we compete? Because China is driven, all innovation is driven by the government, particularly in terms of defense. And so how can we get to a point where we take advantage of our freer system? Because to me, that's how we outcompete them. We develop.
Yeah, you've got to unleash.
You got
to
unleash.
Government has to become an enabler rather than a constrictor, right? And an encourager, if you will, in order to unleash this kind of thing. And this is where we do have a leg up, because they're always constrained. Look at all of the aircraft we saw flying over this parade yesterday. They all look like something built in the West.
Hey, that was the 35 million lines of code they stole from Lockheed, I think. It was on the
F-35. I don't know about that, the airplanes sure look familiar to me. If they weren't Russian knockoffs, their cargo planes look like C-17s. Their stealth fighters look like stealth fighters. Their non-stealth fighters look like Israeli Lavis. And it's just crazy how much their stuff. Their helicopters look like Euro
this
Tiger.
Is how we beat this is how we beat the Soviets. They could never be that innovative. They got lucky periodically where they sort of got something, but you literally had to threaten to kill people's families to force scientists and engineers to, you know, ultimately do something, but it wasn't sustainable. And my fear is will the Chinese find that right mix of freedom and repression that does make it sustainable?
Well, again, I know we're running out of time here, but a lot of people speculate that they've stolen all they need to steal, right? And now they can proliferate their own technology well beyond. And I would argue they are ahead of us in many of the emerging technologies. I'm not read into any systems or classification stuff, so I wouldn't know. But I'm speculating from what I know on open public media that there's a lot of speculation is about whether or not we are ahead or behind in hypersonics, ahead or behind in quantum, ahead or behind in AI, and these sorts of things. And that can all be useful information. But the reality is where are we in the use of it? And I think it's quite clear that the Chinese are going to be much more aggressive in the way they apply this technology than we might. And that is something that we must be worried about.
Yeah, my view is you've got to unleash the competitive spirit that comes from capitalism and have what government doesn't do is allow you to innovate through trying and failing, trying and succeeding, yes, and having a personal interest in what happens. And that's where the success of the United States has always been, whether it was, and in government, what the government does is it provides the platform for implementation into the military. And so, into the national security arena. And so if they can forecast what the needs are, I always tell people, know what you have, know what you want or need, and then know what you want. And it's that one thing that is what people go after. I need another, Coke can. Well, we already have Coke cans. That's not innovation. But what I want is I want a hat that distributes Coca-Cola from it out the sides, and I don't have to refill it every time or something, some craziness like that. If that is a need, then, the innovative spirit of our industries and our small businesses working in partnership do that. But what we've done is we've encumbered them with a bunch of logistical oversight and primary oversight in general. I will not put away safety because safety is important. Environment's important. We always poke to that. But the logistical piece of this really kills the innovation. The idea that I'm going to give you $30,000 to innovate on something that's never been done before. And then I tell you, but you have to do it. Well, if it's never been done before, I don't know I could do it. I think I can, and I'm going to give it my darned best. But scientists just can't invent out of the top of their head something that's never been there before. But I guarantee that an innovator, given the opportunity, will do much better than someone that you say, here are all the boundaries and the structure, and you can't fail. Go for it. They're not going to. Right. They're just not going to put the effort into it. That's the dichotomy we have.
Well, I mean, it's the way, historically in this country and others, the way economics works, it's, most people say, you got to have demand to then you'll get a supply to meet the demand. No. You have a supply, and then whoever creates the supply then ultimately generates the demand. We never knew we needed iPhones. When Steve Jobs went out and said, here's this thing called the iPhone and it's going to do these things, they all of a sudden discovered they couldn't live without it. Yeah. He created demand
after first saying, what do I need that for?
Exactly. And so, and then if you go back and look at military procurement, all McDonnell and Douglas and Lockheed and Martin Marietta and all these, they built stuff and said, here's what it can do. And then the Air Force bought it. We used to have lots and lots of different aircraft.
Right.
And we bought them to keep the aircraft manufacturers going. And we turned them loose and we let them build stuff, and they knew we would buy stuff.
Yeah, they would have fly-offs. Remember the fly-offs?
They innovate because of their self-interest. Going back to your concept of self. Yeah, by the way, Adam, I just want to let you know, in 1975, I don't remember during the entire year ever dropping my phone into the toilet.
Yes.
Not that I have recently, but I couldn't have back then.
No, you would not have. I mean, but
it would have made a big splash. If you dropped
we didn't have toilets back then.
Rotary diet. Right in the outhouse.
Well, all right. Unfortunately, we're long overdue for ending this podcast, so we'll go ahead and do that. Jim, thanks for joining us. Curtis, same to you. Yep. It's been, took a little different turn than I originally expected, but had a good discussion, and hopefully you, the listeners, enjoyed it as well. And so remember, Global Security Review is still out there producing articles. We never took a break. The podcast took a break, but Global Security Review did not. So there's a lot of great articles out there. The HUSI events, there's still a ton going on.
Adam, I just wanted to say, in the last couple of weeks, I've gotten multiple letters from people that listen to our podcast that were not listeners. Get out and tell your friends if you think this is great, because we want them to know too. I just want to get that word out, because we're starting to pick up more listeners. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell everyone. Anyone you run into, just tell them. ThinkDeterrence.com or YouTube, Think Deterrence, and listen to us.
Yeah, it's so great for going to sleep. It's great for insomnia.
Yeah. And not really. Grandma Louise in Des Moines will love it for sure. All right. Well, it was a great show. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to you, the listeners. And we will, of course, see you on the next time. But as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.